welcome to the July edition of BBIOBcast. I'm Francesca Broom, your host and Knowledge Exchange Manager for BBRO. For most of you listening, I'm sure your cereal crop is at the foremost of your mind, with harvest almost upon us. But it's still worth keeping a close eye on your sugar beet crop to ensure a strong, healthy canopy is still in position in a few weeks' time. And it's to that end that we're joined firstly by Professor Mark Stevens to discuss current crop management, and then over to Dr. Alistair Wright and Dr. Kate Allman for a Cercospora update. Well, Mark, here we are. It's July and we're over halfway into the year. So this time of year, your thoughts turn to fungicides normally, but we have a pest that's been, I suppose, no better word for it, a bit of a pest. So what's happening with the issues around moths at the moment?
Well, hello, Ches. Yeah, July is upon us. Can't quite believe we've just survived the Royal Norfolk Show for the last few days. But the phone has been quite busy and various comments. And we have to turn our mind back to 2003, when the last time we really had an issue with this particular pest. And I don't know if you've been in your crops, particularly possibly in coastal Suffolk, but there are sporadic issues of it elsewhere, because we are seeing some caterpillars in the crop. And these tend to be the big juicy green ones, which is aka the silver Y caterpillar. And silver Y is normally a sporadic problem. We probably see low levels every year, but there's been a bit of an uptick. The first calls we had into plant clinic were about 6 weeks ago, about adult moths. And then clearly in the last 10 days, we've had increasing reports of caterpillars. And it is fascinating to see what is going on, because I actually do believe there may be more than one species, and this has been seen before. So there's still one or two investigations that need to be made to work out exactly what the species are. But you can normally determine it from the morphological features of a caterpillar, but there's often no better than a full winged adult moth. What's really helpful about silver Y, once it gets adult moth form, it just, the reason why it's called silver Y is it has a silver Y on its wing. So as we speak, the team have got a cage full of caterpillars and pupae, and we're in the stage of hatching them out just to work out exactly what's going on, because there are some moths that are slightly different colours and different shades, and probably have some different features, so we really need to understand what's going on. But when it comes to moths, there are thresholds, historic thresholds for treatment, and that is 5 green caterpillars per plant. But if you look back on history, when we've had epidemics, it's also quite important sometimes to let nature take its course, because the only treatment we have is the use of pyrethroids. And as we all know, pyrethroids will have a major impact on beneficial insects. The last thing I want to see is pyrethroids used widely, because there are also quite a few black bean aphids about at the moment, as well as the last of the green wingless aphids. And if we start using pyrethroids, then potentially that's going to have consequence on the ladybirds and everything else that are doing a very good job at the moment of managing the aphid populations.
Mark, you did mention that you first saw these 6 weeks ago. So the problems we've seen this last sort of 10 days, is that second generation, or do you think it's just the first generation that's been carried on the wind and spreading?
Great question, Ches. I could do with a crystal ball. Because I could do with knowing what the lottery numbers are tomorrow. If you read all the textbooks, silver white adults migrate from North Africa, the Canary Isles, and the Mediterranean basin on southerly winds through the early part of the spring and into summer, and ultimately end up in the UK. What is interesting because of climate change or climate volatility is there are examples now of silver white overwintering on the south coast of the UK. And let's remember what happened in January and February in 2024, when, February was about 3 to 4 degrees warmer than it should have been. And I just wonder whether, given where we saw, have been seeing the initial outbreak, whether a population of silver Y has overwintered on the Suffolk coastline, which has then enabled it to come into the crop and cause a problem like it's been doing so. It doesn't also then rule out additional populations being moved through on southerly winds, although, we've had a lot of westerlies and northerlies in recent weeks.
Yeah, that would make sense with the fact it's got a lot warmer recently in this last 10 days that it could be on that southerly wind.
But it's definitely one that we need to watch, but just be mindful about treatments. And as I said, we can go back to history, 2003, 1996. My old colleague, Alan Durr, entomologist, is still practicing, wrote a fantastic article in the Beat Review from 1996. And if you go back onto the BBI website or get hold of the Beat Review, just read the article because everything within it is true today, apart from some of the active ingredients. So it's really quite a useful piece of information.
And actually, I'll put that article onto our website. So I'll probably put it under the opinions piece. So if anyone wants to have a look, if you go onto the BBI website and look under the news and opinions, and then you'll be able to catch up and read that piece from Alan, which I know was quite interesting. And I know within that, he talks about silver Y generally being one generation.
They were anticipating a second and it never materialized.
Yeah.
Whether it's weather or parasites or whatever, it had an impact, but it was fascinating to see what happened that year.
In a moment, I'm going to catch up with Alistair and Kate to talk about Cercospora, but there are a number of other foliar diseases that we need to be aware of that could potentially be coming into the crop over the next few weeks. So, do you want to just give me a little bit of an update about what you're seeing so far and the programs you'd recommend?
So, as we're now into July, we will start to see the sort of traditional diseases that come into the crop, as well as the new kid on the block, Cercospora. So, given again how mild it was in February, there is a forecast that based on the number of ground frosts in February and March, and as there were so few, I would anticipate that powdery mildew levels could be quite high. And that's the first disease we tend to normally see. The good news is, early July, we've had no reports of foliar diseases in the crop. But what I would encourage you all to do, particularly if you know where your varieties are in the field and you know the rankings of them for their disease characteristics, is to check those that are more susceptible. So, powdery mildew, as we know, it looks like talcum powder on the leaf, that white bloom. Normally see it around the middle of the month, can be slightly earlier. And given that we've had some warmer weather, settled weather, then that will have helped. So, powdery mildew, then we have rust, tends to come in slightly later than powdery mildew. We normally see it starting to come in mid late August, peaking usually in BBRO trials in mid late October. But again, and very much like happened in 2023, when we had that Indian summer, we had, I think, 7 consecutive days of temperatures above 30, it checked its development. It needs moisture and prefers cooler conditions. But once it reverted back to more traditional conditions, then it built through the rest of the autumn. And again, you get the sporulation and the red pustules erupting from leaves. And again, it's important to get fungicides on the crop to limit the impact of powdery mildew, rust, and also Cercospora. So, when it comes to products, the product list is almost identical to last year, primarily based around the triazoles and strobilurins, and more recently with the SDHIs. And from the BBRO work that we did last year, which was looking at commercial products and product rates, as long as you got the timing right, it didn't really matter too much on product choice. We'd also encourage you to alternate to make sure you're using the different active ingredients, but it was timing and being timely with your applications. But also bearing in mind when you're thinking about lifting, because we saw a clear benefit of a one spray program giving up to 8 adjusted tons benefit, and then a two spray program where we were seeing up to a 20 ton adjusted ton benefit over the untreated. But there didn't seem to be last year any true benefit of a three spray program, but that can vary from year to year. And often a three-spray program, if there's a lot of disease in the autumn, then the benefits can be, particularly for beet, lifted after Christmas and helps promote sugar concentration.
And of course, the main thing to think about as well is it's the interval between those sprays, yeah. Isn't it? So don't let the disease get back in and develop again. Yeah.
Correct. So if you are going for a later lift and you are thinking about a two or a three-spray strategy, clearly, you're applying your fungicides to control disease. But what we see from our own BBRO work is you're making sure that you're going back in within about 28 days. Because if you open that window, we've seen it quite a few times, and we often get comments, oh, products aren't working. But then you start to interrogate a bit further and you appreciate that the second application or the third application went on about 6, 7, 8 weeks after the one previous, and clearly the first one or second one's then run out of steam and enabled the disease to actually get a foothold, and then you're always firefighting against the problem.
That's great. So thank you very much, Mark. I think that's enough to keep the growers on their toes for the rest of July, and we'll certainly update them with things in the advisory bulletin as they progress.
Exactly. And as soon as we start seeing diseases, we'll flag that in the bulletin. And again, if you're interested about what we saw with the BBRO fungicide trial, the commercial trial that we did in 2023, that was in the Beet Review as well in the last edition. So something as a reference point if you wanted to go and check about what we found with regard to disease control and ultimately the final yields that we achieved as well.
Yeah, and I'll make sure there's a link to that from our advisory bulletin that goes out next time.
Perfect.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Not at all, Jess.
We'll leave Mark with his crystal ball and we move on to a different kind of forecasting with Alistair and Kate, who have been working on Cercospora, which is a relatively new foliar disease in the UK and one in which they're making quite a mark in. So let's hear more from both of them.
Obviously, we know Cercospora's becoming more of a problem in the UK. We had our first major outbreak 4 years ago, and we're now starting our diagnostics and monitoring work for the season. Kate's been busy in the lab testing all of the 300-odd samples from last year, and we've got some exciting data that we can talk about in a bit. But I think the most pressing issue is obviously the testing and live monitoring we'll be doing this season.
What was it you were doing last year? So you've collected all the Spornado cartridges here. What have you actually seen from that?
Probably good to start with what the Spornados are. I know we've been showing them off at various events and I'm very pleased with them, but they're sort of these 3D printed funnels, catch spores on the wind. They start orange, but they fade fairly quickly to sort of a off-white colour.
And they're solar powered, aren't they?
They're solar powered, yeah. They come from Canada. And there's a cartridge in there that's about 4 or 5 centimetres in diameter, and that's got a very fine mesh in it. Once the cartridge is popped out, comes into the lab, and then Kate's able to extract the spores off it.
And is it just spores you're looking at, Kate?
So that's what the Spornados are sampling, but this year we're going to develop it further. We will then be looking at Cercospora on the plants, both once you see symptoms and hopefully trying to detect Cercospora in the leaves before you ever see it.
So let's go back. So we tried this for the first time last year and obviously collected all the cartridges. And I know that we've now got results from all those cartridges that were collected. So first of all, how many have you had to process, Kate?
So I think in total we collected about 330 cartridges last year between May and September from 11 sites?
12.
12 sites.
Should have been 12.
We're nearing completion of processing all of those.
Yes, we are.
Kate will obviously tell you about the assays we're using now in our lab, but then the next step is they'll go across the pond, literally here on the research park, to the Earlham Institute, where they're going to sort of do some in-depth sequencing, stuff I don't really understand, but really to look at the genetic makeup of the Cercospora populations we have here in the UK, which is really novel and exciting and will give us a great insight to sort of the resistance profiles we have available.
So you're expecting to find the big variants of genetic makeup?
I think it's a great unknown at this stage. So clearly having wild populations of sea beet around the coast acts as sort of a natural reservoir, and that's Dr. Mark McMullen, his lab group, he's an evolutionary biologist, and that's their main focus, is looking at the differences between our agricultural populations of pathogens and also their wild counterparts on the sea beet. And clearly Norfolk's a perfect test bed for sugar beet for that reason, with all the sea beet around the coast. But they're also interested in rust as well. So it's a really good partnership we've built up.
So, Kate, from what you've processed so far, what have you actually found?
At most sites, we've found that Cercospora spores are usually being identified in sort of early to mid-July, and symptoms on the plants were reported 3 or 4 weeks after those spores were identified. So we're interested this year in looking at whether we can detect Cercospora in the plant in that period between detecting spores and those first spots being seen on the plant.
So if the Cercospora is in the air and going into the actual funnel of the spornado, are you confident that if it's in the air, it's actually going on the plant at some point, or do you just think it's going to be there every day?
Well, that was the main theory we were testing. So the spornadoes are being used in North America as well, in the Red River Valley, and they're finding spores pretty much on the air all year round. And I was worried that would be the case here in the UK, but it is interesting to see this sort of later influx of spores that we are sampling. We have to assume sort of what we're catching on the air is the same as the plants will receive. And then Cercospora needs a favourable weather event for those spores then to germinate and infect the plant. Normally, well, we think it's normally a high 20s temperature, but some of the work Kate's been doing in the lab, we've seen the Cercospora isolates really thrive at a lower temperature. So it's probably adjusting to our British climate more than we suspected. But also we know wet weather and leaf wetness is one of those key drivers. So
I was going to say, is humidity have a factor? Because I know with the Cercospora risk forecasting, that takes humidity into consideration, doesn't it?
That's right. So that's all based on the existing model from America, which came to us via Spain. And clearly we've now used for several years, but we're really now trying to refine that. Do we need to lower the temperature threshold? Is there a way of actually simulating leaf wetness rather than just humidity? It's that wetness that really is driving those spores to germinate. Clearly, humidity can be high and a leaf can be dry still, but actually you need a wet leaf for a prolonged period. So
it's almost that we're looking at three tiers, aren't we? We've got the risk forecasting that's going on, the existing model. We've got the Sencrop systems are still doing leaf wetness in the field as well. We're taking the measurement there. We've then got Spornado collecting the spores themselves. So actually, if we layer those three, we should be able to help with the forecasting and give a much better direction to the growers.
That's right. So once a week, we'll be issuing a map as well this year, which will take into account all these different tiers. So obviously, we'll still have the main postcode-based monitoring alert system that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. But once a week, we'll be updating it, similar to sort of the aphid map. So each of our 17 monitoring sites will annotate the map up with whether we caught spores or not. And then once we've caught spores, have we detected any samples in the leaf, which is the next tier. So I think we're going to sample, 10 leaves per site as soon as we catch spores, really see can we detect them in that latent period when there's no symptoms, but we expect there will be. There's normally about a two and a half week period when the disease is germinating inside the leaf and clearly causing some yield loss. And then of course reporting when we're seeing symptoms on the crop.
And this is quite a step up for the plant clinic and the lab, isn't it, Kate? Because obviously in the last year you collected all the Spornado cartridges, and then after the summer months, when we're probably our busiest, you then started to process them. But this is actually going to be a much more timely process.
Yes, so the diagnostic testing was a brand new endeavour for us for processing the cartridges from 2023. So it took us a little while to make sure that we were doing everything best way to get the best results. We've taken advice and things from colleagues in North America who are using this system and collaborating with the Earlham Institute here on the Research Park to make sure that the data we get out of these gives us the best information. So now that we've got all our systems in place, we are aiming to have it live, up and running this year.
No aiming about it. We are going to have this process running because I know there's been a lot of commitment from all of the team to make this happen. And I think it's going to be great for the growers to actually receive that kind of up-to-the-minute information from us, because we've not been able to do that on particularly the Cercospora previously.
So obviously it doesn't change on-farm behaviour, and I don't want to encourage anyone to get too complacent about it, because we know it is such a devastating disease if it takes hold, but we know that early treatment is going to be vital. So spraying as soon as you see disease symptoms and using the correct chemistry at the right timing will really protect those crops. And if this wet weather continues for the rest of the summer and then we get some really high temperatures, I imagine Cercospora could be a major threat. So really we're doing all we can to really advise that process as quickly as possible.
And it's a double whammy, really, because, yes, you'll lose the canopy. People need to also be aware that if they're looking to try and harvest late, no canopy and a bit of frost, we know the damage we've had in previous years. So keeping that canopy as healthy as possible and on top of any of your foliar diseases is really important, isn't it?
Yes, and even for those delivering early, the crop will use up a lot of its sugar reserves to generate new leaf area, because of course Cercospora doesn't kill the plant, so the plant will want to regrow leaf area. So really at any stage through the campaign, Cercospora, if you've lost canopy to it, you've lost a lot of yield. So it is all about timely control and really looking at that spread across the whole growing area.
Right, we know where we are now. In future, so once we get this project on the go, what are you hoping to actually do in perhaps changing behaviours going forward?
Well, I suppose that comes on to the latent leaf testing we're going to be doing. At this stage, when we catch spores on the Spornado, we know we've got at least two weeks until we're going to see symptoms. It's then detecting at what point actually has the disease taken hold inside the leaf. So we'll be asking for at our monitoring sites 10 leaves per week after we've caught the spores initially to see if we can detect this latent infection. And if we can do that, then hopefully with a bit of trials work, we'll be looking at pre-symptomatic spraying to really halt the disease in its progress. That's not approved for use on a broad acre scale. Of course, this is under trials permits. But really, I think if we can prove that we've got a reliable way of detecting it in leaf, or a way of modelling that, we can look at spraying in a more timely fashion, hopefully reducing the amount of fungicides we even need. Of course, if you're removing it from sporulating and showing those disease symptoms, you're then reducing how much inoculum there is to spread through the crop. So it should be like a double positive, really. So we've got a lot of work to do on refining that as well. We've got some brand new weather stations that are being put together at the moment. That's what I spent all day yesterday doing, and that really is looking at measuring far more of the conditions within the crop itself and in the local environment to see what can we correlate with disease symptoms as well. So
probably another 3 years before we can actually have some clear data?
At least, probably, but we'll see how we go. If technology changes and there's a way of doing it on farm with like a lateral flow test, or perhaps we could see change even sooner. But some of it is just good messaging about which fungicide to use and when. If it means just spending a little more early on to get a different suite of chemistry on the crop, that might well pay off on your second or third spray. So some of the messaging we hope will come through sooner, but of course some of the major changes in behaviour I think will need a lot of solid data to convince our regulators. It's the right thing to do.
Right. Well, I know, do know, Alistair, that you're writing a great piece for us for the next Beet Review, which is going to be out in September, but also for growers to please watch out for any messaging that comes through, whether it be the text alerts or via the advisory bulletin. We'll keep you updated as to what's happening on the Cercospora front throughout the rest of this year.
We will indeed, yes.
Yeah, so thank you both very much.
Thanks, Jess.
That brings us to the end of the July edition of Beetcast. But we're far from the end of the sugar beet season, so please do remain vigilant for any pests and diseases. And remember, the Plant Clinic is here to help. So do keep in contact and also watch out for our updates via the advisory bulletin. For those of you requiring basis points, this month's reference is CP/138691/2425/K. And that just leaves me to say thank you very much for listening.